Welcome to the podcast from the Washington Policy Center Annual Dinner, held at the Davenport Grand Hotel on September 24th, 2015. This broadcast is brought to you by our friends at Washington Trust Bank. Now, we join our hosts, Kent Adams and Sulani Madsen.
Washington Policy Center's annual dinner event would not be possible without wonderful, wonderful sponsors. The platinum sponsor of tonight's event is Washington Trust Bank. Gold sponsors of the Eastern Washington Annual Dinner, Kent and Bonnie Clausen, and Telect. WPC's silver sponsors tonight include Breakthrough Incorporated, Tippett Company, Ann Coles, Dwayne Alton, Ron and Heidi Stanley, and Wells Fargo. And our VIP table sponsors of tonight's event are Avista Corporation, AT&T, Senske Lawn and Tree Care, Transsystem Incorporated, Physicians Insurance, Julie Shiflett, and Larry Larison. Thank you so much for our sponsors. There are dozens of table sponsors we also wish to thank who are listed in your programs this evening. Please join us in recognizing all of our sponsors who have made tonight's annual dinner festivities possible. We also wish to recognize our elected officials in the room, and there are many of them, including state legislators and the mayor of the city of Spokane, David Condon. I saw him back in the room somewhere. Now, if all of our elected officials would please stand, there are so many tonight, we may actually have a quorum. Let's see. All of our elected officials, please let us recognize you. Thank you so much for your service. The job isn't easy. Well, sitting here at the head table this evening, from stage left, former commander of Fairchild Air Force Base and now head of Leadership Spokane, Colonel Brian Newberry and his wife Jill. So Jill and Colonel Newberry. And Colonel Newberry will be introducing Ambassador Bolton, who is sitting right next to him. Well, you'll hear from this fella soon. And of course, I'm Robin. On the other side here, the recipient of WPC's Champion of Freedom Award, former Congressman Doc Hastings. WPC President Dan Mead Smith. WPC Board of Directors member and former Congressman George Nethercutt. WPC Eastern Washington Director Chris Cargill and his lovely wife Lisa. And economist Steve Moore. Now, I have a few housekeeping notes. There were several items in your ticket packages tonight, including an annual dinner survey. So take the time throughout the evening at some point and please fill that out. Give us feedback as the WPC staff begins to plan for next year's event. This really does help. It is now my pleasure to turn the podium over to the president of Washington Policy Center, Mr. Dan Mead Smith.
Thank you, Robin. As Robin said, I'm the president of the Policy Center, Dan Mead Smith, and I want to thank all of you for being here this evening. This is incredible to see this many people at our sixth annual Eastern Washington dinner. You make this Eastern Washington office what it is. So thank you for being part of all we do throughout the year, not just tonight, but throughout the entire year. I want to touch on one aspect of Washington Policy Center. Our board chairman, Craig Williamson, is going to talk about several of our items that we're having an impact on. And I was just interviewed on the radio, and someone said, what's the most exciting thing or the most thing you're most proud of over the last couple of years? And it really is our Young Professionals Program. We've had some great policy victories, which you'll hear about from Craig and from Chris, but to look at what we're doing now and the young people who have joined with us is very rewarding, and I think you'll be very excited to hear how the next generation of leaders is part of the Washington Policy Center. Our Young Professionals program started about 5 years ago, and our effort to engage and educate young people in their 20s and 30s on policy issues. And we started a Young Professional Advisory Board, and that board has now grown into 20 people from around the state who lead our Young Professional program, whether it's marketing our message to that age demographic, holding networking events. There'll be 350 young professionals at our annual dinner in a couple weeks in Seattle. And now, as you heard from Robin, we have three college clubs. So students have come to us and said, we want to start a Washington Policy Center club on our campus. Rather than us going to them and saying, hey, we need to start clubs on campuses, students are coming to us, which is very exciting. So this year, we opened a club on Washington State University campus. You met Sophia and Stephanie doing the pledge. They're the leaders of our club. They brought up 20 students from Pullman tonight to attend the dinner, which is great. And then we also have about 30 students from Gonzaga here this evening as well. We've held debates at Gonzaga now for the last 2 years, where we have 300 students come and learn about policy issues. Steve Moore, one of our speakers tonight, spoke at our minimum wage debate last year at Gonzaga. So these are very well-attended events. And as the students told us, there's lots of speakers on campus, but there's never any debates. We never hear both sides of an issue. So that's what attracts them to a Washington Policy Center event on their campus. This is a key part of our organization as we educate those people getting started on their careers about the importance of public policy issues and free market solutions. And your support is making this engagement and outreach possible. In addition to our intern program, where we hire interns every quarter in our offices, Sophia Steele, who did the pledge, she interned for us this summer. We also give out a $5,000 a year annual scholarship to an emerging female leader. And it's my pleasure tonight to announce our 2015 Jennifer Dunn Thompson Scholarship recipient from the Washington Policy Center. As most of you know, Jennifer Dunn was one of our state's key political and policy figures for 3 decades, including her service in Congress in the 90s, where she served with both George Nethercutt and Doc Hastings. She quickly rose up the ranks to serve in leadership, which included vice chairman of the Republican Conference, a member of the Ways and Means Committee, and the first woman to run for House Majority Leader. During her 12 years in the House of Representatives, she was an advocate for small business and the elimination of the death tax, key Washington Policy Center issues. And she also sponsored the bill that started the Amber Alert System. 10 years ago this year, Washington Policy Center recognized her distinguished career and leadership with our Champion of Freedom Award that Congressman Hastings will receive tonight. Jennifer passed away not long after we gave her the award, at too young of an age, but her family wanted to carry on her tradition and legacy, and they left Washington Policy Center funding for 5 years to give out this scholarship. This is the 5th year of us giving out the Jennifer Dunn Thompson Scholarship. To a female college student that embodies the former Congresswoman's leadership characteristics and funded through the Washington Policy Center. We received a record number of applicants for the 2nd straight year, but again, one applicant rose to the top, Haley Homan. Haley is from right here in Spokane, graduated as valedictorian from Mount Spokane High School, is a Washington State University student in their Honors College. She is studying quantitative economics with a minor in mathematics and political science. And this is our 2nd straight year of giving our Jennifer Dunn Award from somebody from Washington State University in Eastern Washington. She's the president of the Washington Student Association, which is the association that lobbies for all college students from every university around the state that lobbies in Olympia. She's the chief of staff at the Associated Students of Washington State University, which is the Washington State University student government. And her plan is to be an economist and work to create public policy that is fiscally responsible and helps those in need. Very dear to the hearts of Washington Policy Center. What stood out to us, other than her numerous activities that I just mentioned, was helping those that will fall behind her. Assisting others to reach their potential is a passion of hers. She believes that everyone should be given an opportunity to thrive, and she strives to include others in all of her work. She's an advocate for those who are unable to do so for themselves from her positions on the Student Conduct Board, Legislative Affairs, or Student Government. Her core principles can be summed up in mentorship and advocacy. So our 2015 Jennifer Dunn Thompson Scholarship goes to Haley Homan for proudly reflecting the leadership commitment to public service and personal values of Jennifer Dunn Thompson, for representing the bright promise of a rising generation, and for exemplifying the talent, hard work, and willingness to carry on Jennifer's ideals into the future. Presented at the 2015 Annual Dinner of Washington Policy Center in Spokane on September 24th, 2015. Haley?
Thank you so much, everyone. It's a huge honor to be here tonight, and it's even a bigger honor to be the recipient of this scholarship. The support I've received from the Washington Policy Center has helped me so much in my studies, and they're pretty difficult studies too, so the support is extra well received. But I just can't say from the bottom of my heart enough how absolutely thankful I am for this award, and also to be even associated with the legacy of the great Congresswoman Dunn. So thank you so much again, and because I'm from WSU, go Cougs!
Congratulations, Haley. We look forward to working with you and watching you as you graduate next year and start on your path to be an economist and continue to blossom into a leader in our state. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our board chairman, Craig Williamson. Craig is the owner of a small business in Redmond, MM Comfort System. Craig is our new chairman this year and has served on our board of directors for the last several years, including chairman of our very important marketing committee, and as the last 2 years as our vice chairman. It's great to have Craig with us tonight in Spokane. Craig?
Wow, thank you, Dan. I just can't tell you how proud I am to be associated with the Washington Policy Center, how great it is to be here in Spokane. I've got a pattern of tearing up for weddings, and I get to confess tonight I teared up for the national anthem. That was just outrageous. Really good. Thank you all for being here. You're in for a terrific night as we build on 6 years of accelerating success in Eastern Washington. We're thrilled to welcome our distinguished friends, Ambassador John Bolton, and clear-thinking, straight-talking Stephen Moore. They're going to do a great job tonight. As a business owner with over 100 employees, I have firsthand knowledge of the impact that state policy has on the lives of real people and real businesses. And believe me, the work of Washington Policy Center has never been more urgent. Forces for bigger government, more programs, taxes, and regulations threaten to eclipse our nation's founding values around freedom and free enterprise. 2015 is shaping up to be another blockbuster year for Washington Policy Center. Washington Policy Center remains committed to providing Washington voters with information and analysis that they need to ensure the preservation of the American dream. The informed citizenry is foundational to the unique magic of the American system, and Washington Policy Center is doing the heavy lifting to provide the information that people need. While competition around ideas is dynamic, our core principles are not. First, freedom, free markets, and personal responsibility work in tandem to reduce need for reliance on government. Second, balanced budgets, lower taxes and less regulation preserve the healthy ecosystems that we need to provide growth, opportunities, and long-term security. In 2013, Washington Policy Center established a strategic plan that focused on engaging more citizens and expanding the base of people that we serve. And this plan included the outreach to the young professionals, which Dan talked about, which has been a huge success. To tell you the truth, I teared up a little bit when Dan was making the award. That was just terrific. But beyond that, we've committed to expanding our presence geographically. And this fabulous venue that we're in tonight with you in the room is an example of that. We now enjoy a strong physical presence in Seattle, Olympia, Spokane, and the Tri-Cities. Quite a remarkable accomplishment given where we started from. Additionally, we recognize that a lot of the material that we deal with is challenging. It's analytical. It can be a little bit wonkish at times, and we need to be able to connect with people on their terms. And so part of the strategic plan included an attempt to humanize our message with the use of videos and images and real-life stories. And I'd like to share with you a brief video that's an example of that. This one happens to be dealing with the minimum wage issue through the lens of an employer. This video will give you a sense for the type of progress we're making in humanizing our message. With the video.
I've already finished my AAS in network administrations with the help of Cascade Designs.
Entry-level jobs provide young and unskilled workers with an important platform to gain the experience they need to command higher wages throughout their career. That is why two-thirds of minimum wage earners receive an increase within their first year on the job.
Every year I'm being promoted. In fact, I've been promoted 6 times now until I became the IT operations manager. In fact, I'm not the only one that really moved from shipping to IT. There were 4 of us that the company helped, and we were all sent to college for free. And now, yeah, I made it to the top.
An entry-level job is more than just a job. It is an important opportunity for unskilled workers to begin a career.
To learn more about the unintended consequences of increasing the minimum wage, visit Washington Policy Center's website, www.washingtonpolicy.org.
Great, thank you for that. So that would be an example of what we're trying to do to make a human connection with some of the policy stuff that we're working on. The Washington Policy Center is not only about ideas, and it's not only about values, it's about results. And I believe on your table there's a flyer that includes a list of some of the top achievements of the Washington Policy Center in recent times. These achievements are like the movie credits at the end of a movie. They just go on and on and on. So this just represents the most current list. And I would draw your attention to a couple. We've come off of a brutal legislative session. And you may not know that the Washington Policy Center was invited to testify 41 times before the legislature, and 51 bills were introduced that reflected Washington Policy Center recommendations. In addition, yes, that's really something. Washington Policy Center was instrumental in defeating proposals for up to $1.5 billion in new taxes this last legislative session. Yep. And we also had a voice in Spokane's rejecting a tax increase for an expensive trolley system, offering more efficient alternatives instead. Hopefully you're pleased with that. While the success thus far is cause for encouragement, the battle lies before us. The work is never done, and I'll draw your attention to a couple of immediate priorities we'll be working on going forward. The first is charter schools. We were able to be a strong voice to help bring about the enactment of charter schools in Washington State. And that program is under attack. There's things happening that are resisting full implementation in the Washington Policy Center in classic fashion. We'll not relent, we'll not give up, we'll not stop working on the issue, and we will continue to advocate for choice of families, education. The thing about results is you have to hang with it all the way through, so we're not going to give up on that one. And another issue that maybe hasn't gotten as much attention on your radar is the notion of labor reform. Now, there's a competitive marketplace that takes place between states. Washington State has a wonderful advantage in that we don't have an income tax. Unfortunately, we've got some disadvantages. One of them is we are not a right-to-work state. You may not realize, but if you have a public sector job, and there's hundreds and thousands of them across our state, you are required, it's mandatory that you're a member of a union. And it's mandatory that you have payroll deduction that goes to fund that union, but most importantly, to fund political purposes, the causes and people elected that you may not support. So labor reform, right to work is part of it. You may have picked up on last week's article, Washington State ranked dead last nationwide in workers' compensation. We have our state monopoly system for workers' compensation is the single most expensive system in the nation. And that would fall under our labor reform work, and you'll see us chipping away at programs like that. And we would like to invite you, we would like to plead with you to continue to join with us in support. At your table, there's a white card that provides you with an opportunity to refresh, increase, initiate your sponsorship, your support of the Washington Policy Center. We're asking you to do that this evening. I would point out that if you have an area of particular interest, environment, education, transportation, small business, you can direct your support at a specific center if you've got a passion, so feel free to do that. And then additionally, we have an enormously successful Pillar Society. Would all members of the Pillar Society please stand up? I think you know who you are. If you're a member of the Pillar Society, could you please stand? Come on, I know you're out there. There's lots of you. Don't be shy. There's an entire brochure at your table that will help you get acquainted with the benefits of becoming a member of our Pillar Society, and there are many invitations to private events, invitation to participate in the policy formation process. We invite you, encourage you to become a member of the Pillar Society. So with that, I would like to just tip my hat to the tremendous work that's being done in Eastern Washington, in particular, the leader of the band out here, Chris Cargill. I would put him in the true rock star category. Chris, would you?
Well, thanks very much, Craig. Good evening, everyone. We're here in the center. We decided to come down with all of you and get away from the podium for a little while to change it up a little bit. How do you like it? A little better, right? We get a lot of feedback each and every year from all of you on this annual dinner, so I hope you'll take the time to, you've been asked to do, fill out that annual dinner survey. I wish to impress upon you just a couple of details about the Eastern Washington activities that are going on, because I know you're here tonight to hear from our two speakers, so I don't want to take up a lot of time. And we'll talk with our speakers in just a couple of minutes, but there are many things that are going on in Eastern Washington, but when I sat down to kind of put my thoughts together, I thought it would be important to just point out a couple of things that you may all be interested in or things that may make you remember about what's going on here in Eastern Washington. The first is a recognition of the experience that we have leading the organization. And it's not me, it's our Eastern Washington Advisory Board members. And there's a sheet inside all of these white folders that are at your table that list all of our Eastern Washington Advisory Board members. If they would just please quickly stand so they can be recognized. These are the men and women who lead our efforts here in Eastern Washington, and they're mostly our table captains here this evening. So thank you to all of our Eastern Washington Advisory Board members. For those of you who are already supporters of WPC, or for those of you considering supporting WPC, consider this fact. For the first 5 years that we opened the Eastern Washington office, we were getting about 300 to 400 media hits each and every year. A media hit is a mention of WPC research or recommendations in a newspaper or online or on a TV story or a radio story. In the past year, just since January 1st to today, September 24th, we have had 800 media hits in Eastern Washington, more than double. And we are on pace to have 1,000 media hits in Eastern Washington. So that means the support that you all give the Policy Center is having an impact. The research that we do is in the media and getting the attention that it deserves. And the third thing, everybody, look at your folders if you have a free hand. Look at the back of your folders. You'll see all the different research centers that we have at Washington Policy Center, C Center for Education, Environment, Government Reform, Healthcare, Small Business, Transportation. We also do some technology and telecommunications work once in a while. What's one thing on there, or a couple of things on there, that are specifically important to Eastern Washington that perhaps we're missing? Agriculture, energy, water issues. And we recognize that at Washington Policy Center. And so over the past few years, we've been getting together a group of key stakeholders to discuss whether there is indeed a need for a free market perspective on those issues. And we have determined, yes, indeed, there is a need. So over the next year, we hope to make an exciting announcement about perhaps adding another line to the back of your folder there and expanding our research into that field. So we hope you'll join us in that effort and stay tuned for that exciting announcement perhaps in the next year or so. Let us know if you have an interest specifically in that effort, and we'd love to have you join us. So with that, I'm gonna take a walk down the catwalk here and introduce our first speaker, who is a very impressive, someone called him once an economic egghead. And that's a compliment. Steve Moore is the chief economist at the Heritage Foundation. He is also a former editorial board member with the Wall Street Journal. He is a graduate with a master in economics from George Mason University. Politico magazine did a full-page spread of Steve earlier this year and said that many of the presidential candidates were wooing him to join their side to, let me make sure I read this correctly, to make them, quote, look smart and burnish thin resumes. So I am pleased that we have such a smart guy with us here this evening. If you would help me welcome Steve Moore. Steve, thanks very much. I want to start with something that's going on right now, and that is this discussion in Congress. The Pope was there today. I'm not talking about that, but perhaps he provided a little divine intervention with this budget conversation. We're a couple of days away from a budget deadline. Are we going to get a budget deal before October 1st, or are we going to head into a government shutdown?
Well, first of all, Chris, it is really an honor to be here with you all tonight. Thank you so much for your support of this incredible organization, Washington Policy Center. I spend a lot of my time on the road. I work very closely with our conservative state think tanks all around the country. It is amazing how we're winning on the state level. We're winning everywhere. It is really astonishing, and it's because of groups like the Washington Policy Center. And I should say this, that you know, we have some really great state think tanks, as you know, Chris, around the country. In Arizona, we have the Goldwater Institute, and in Michigan, we have the Mackinac Center. In Texas, we have the Texas Public Policy Foundation. But I gotta tell you this, you should be very proud of WPC. I would say that of the 50 state think tanks, you have one of the most powerful and impactful state think tank right here in Washington State. It's amazing what you guys have accomplished. So Dan, congratulations to you. And it's just so wonderful to be here. One other just quick thing before I answer Chris's question. How many in this room watch Fox News pretty regularly? Raise your hand. It is, I had such a warm reception when I came into Spokane this morning. I was in the airport terminal and was walking, you know, I got a really early flight. I was in Houston this morning. And so I was kind of really tired and I was carrying my bags through the terminal. And this lovely Washington woman, she just ran up to me and she threw her arms around me. She was so excited and it was just great and very endearing. And she said, "I know you, don't I?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, ma'am." She was so cute. And she said, "I'm sure I've seen you on TV." And I just thought I'd, you know, kind of flummoxed her a little bit. So I said, "Well, I'm not sure, ma'am." I said, what do you watch?" And that kind of puzzled her a little bit. She kept looking up at me with this, you know, golden smile. And then the light bulb finally went on and she said, "Wait a minute," she said, "didn't I see you on Wheel of Fortune last week?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, that was that was me." But anyway, it's just quite an honor to be here, and what you do is so impactful. Okay, so you asked me about this budget deal, and I'm going to start by saying something that I wonder how many of you agree with me. I think the Republicans should pass every single appropriation bill and every single appropriation bill that is passed by the Republican Party, because the Republicans, as you know, run the House and Senate, should have a provision in that bill that not one penny should go to Planned Parenthood. Not one single penny should go to Planned Parenthood. Because, and it doesn't matter, look, I know some people are pro-life and pro-choice. It doesn't matter. This is about whether taxpayer dollars, your and my taxpayer dollars, should go to an organization that is involved in what I believe is just an immorally incomprehensible type of behavior. Now, this is going to be a big issue, Chris, because there's going to be a big showdown, actually within the Republican Party, about whether John Boehner and whether Mitch McConnell have the fortitude to do this. And my feeling is, send that bill to the President Obama, and let's see what he does with that. Is President Obama going to shut down the United States government because he wants to fund an organization that we now know is selling body parts? And let's elevate this issue so every American can see those videos and see what goes on in this organization that gets $500 million. $500 million a year goes to Planned Parenthood. So that's issue number one. The other issue, Chris, is what are we going to do about these budget caps? As you know, back in 2000, I think it was about 2011, remember when we had the fiscal cliff negotiations, and Republicans actually did, I think, Congressman Hastings, I think we did a pretty good job. We got some pretty tight spending caps out of this president. The problem, Chris, is that President Obama every year wants to slip out of those caps. And by the way, you know, President Obama held a press conference 3 weeks ago bragging about how the fact that, you know, the budget deficit, you know, was $1.5 trillion in his first term, and now it's all the way down to $500 billion. And he's saying, "Oh, look at the progress we've made." What he did not mention is the single greatest reason we've seen progress in reducing that budget deficit is because of the sequester and the caps. And I believe, and I wonder how many of you are with me, we cannot let President Obama out of those caps. Republicans should stick to those budget caps this year so we continue to make progress. Because look, if Republicans are truly the party of small government, as they say are there when they run for office, then why in the world would we want to raise these caps by 70, 80, $100 billion? So that's going to be the other big issue, Chris. And I'm on the side of keeping the spending caps, keeping the sequester, and then in 2016, when we get a president who actually is pro-business and wants to balance this budget, then we can talk about cutting the entitlement programs.
So let's talk about the presidential candidates then. Yeah. We saw the presidential debate last week. Was it last week? Yeah, just last week. Time flies. We saw the presidential debate last week. A lot of candidates throwing out their economic plans. Governor Bush has a 4%.
Well, I got to say about that presidential debate, I have Carly mania. I think Carly is an unbelievable talent, and I think it is so unbelievable. How many of you think she won that debate? She was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, we're just seeing an emergence of stars right now. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I know that this is not a partisan event, but you know, you compare the talent that is on that podium in the Republican primary. I mean, those are people who are smart, they're talented, they're people of achievement. I like any of their chances against Hillary Clinton. Any one of them against Hillary, I like their chances. So I just had to get that off my chest, because
sure.
I think you're seeing, I mean, look, which is the party of diversity? Look at the people on that stage. We have, you know, Ben Carson. I mean, is there a greater story. I mean, I know, Dan, you had, what was it, last year you had Ben Carson in Seattle. I mean, what a story. Only in America. Ben Carson grows up in Detroit, in the ghettos of Detroit, without a father, you know, facing all sorts of adversity, and becomes the greatest surgeon in the world. I mean, that's a kind of only in America story. And then you've got people, how many times have the media mentioned that two of the Republican candidates are Hispanic? Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. And, you know, you've got a woman. So, the Rainbow Coalition, the party that looks like America today, is the Republican Party, and the Democrats are basically a bunch of liberal left-wingers. Well, I know that wasn't your question, but I had to get that fine. Off my
One of
chest.
The candidates, Governor Bush, has talked often about his 4% growth
yes.
plan. And I know you talked today at lunch a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, is 4% perhaps a little bit too low? Should
yeah.
we be aiming for higher? I mean, as you well know, when President Reagan was in office, I mean, we were hitting 6%, even higher than that, in,
yeah.
in some cases, 7.
Well, you know, I worked for President Reagan, as I think you did, Ambassador, and I think that, you know, if you look at what happened under Ronald Reagan, I mean, he showed us the way, right? I mean, Reagan came in, what happened? We cut tax rates, we reduced regulation, we got inflation under control. I mean, how many of you remember 20% inflation under, 20% mortgage interest rates under Jimmy Carter and, 14% inflation? The economy was deindustrializing when Ronald Reagan came into office, and he turned this economy around on a dime. Through the tax rate reductions, through the deregulation, through getting money, a sound dollar, something that we don't have right now with these ridiculous zero interest rate policies. Reagan basically let the supply side, the businesses of America, grow us out of a recovery. And I mention that, Chris, because we had quarters under Ronald Reagan where the economy grew by 8%. We had one quarter, it grew 8.7%. We had 1 month under Ronald Reagan, we created 1 million jobs in 1 month. Can you imagine what Barack Obama would do if he could create 1 million jobs in 1 month? I mean, he would be doing cartwheels down Pennsylvania Avenue. And this was an agenda that worked. And you contrast that, and this has to be our message as free market conservatives. Contrast that with what has happened under Barack Obama. Now, look, Barack Obama came in office in a great economic crisis as well. But look at what has happened in this so-called recovery. First of all, the economy has only grown by 2%, which is pathetic. That's pitiful. That's treading water. And, Obama is running around the country doing the icky shuffle in the end zone like he's resolved all the problems of this country, and the American people don't believe him. And you want an amazing statistic that I think every candidate and every one of us as free market conservatives should throw in the face of our liberal friends every time we debate them, is this one. That the Census Bureau just came out with data last week about what has happened to family income in America, Chris. What has happened to the average median working class family in America? Since the recovery began in June of 2009, the average family in America has lost $1,500 of real income under Barack Obama. $1,500. And by the way, I hope there is no one in this room who believes the unemployment rate in this country is 5.2%, because it is not anywhere near 5.2%. I mean, if you look at the people who have dropped out of the workforce, we have the lowest labor force participation rate in this country since 1978, since Jimmy Carter was in office. And why are people dropping out of the labor force? Because they can't find a job. And who are the people who are dropping out of the labor force? They're young people, Chris. They're the biggest decline in the labor force participation rate has been people below the age of 30. And partly, by the way, that's because of raising the minimum wage, which is pricing a lot of young people out of the workforce. So we have to take the offensive on the economy, and we have to talk about how we create 4 to 5 to 6% growth. Now, I met with Jeb Bush just last week when right before he introduced his tax plan. I did a little bit of work on this, and I got to tell you, I told him the same question you asked me. I said, Jeb, I like 4%, but let's aim for 5 or 6%. We can do this. We're so below trend. You know, I'll give you an amazing statistic. I don't want to go on off on this, but this is important stuff. If the U.S. economy had grown as fast under Barack Obama in the last 6 years as it did under Ronald Reagan, the U.S. economy today would be $3 trillion larger. $3 trillion larger. Now, that's an enormous number. It's incomprehensible it's so large. But let me give you a sense of how big that number is. $3 trillion, that's the equivalent of $20,000 for every family in America. And that's what we should tell the American people. We can grow this fast if we put the right kind of economic programs together. And let me just, if I may, just take 1 second on this. There are four things we could do. Look, There's so much low-hanging fruit out there. We could get the economic growth rate in this country up to 4 to 5% in a snap if we had a president who wanted to do it. And I'll give you four quick things. Number one, let's make America not only energy independent, but the energy dominant country in this world by using our natural resources. I just got back. On Tuesday, I was in Fargo. How many of you ever been to Fargo, North Dakota? I was in North Dakota this week. North Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate of any state in the country. And what is going on there with the oil development and the shale oil and gas is one of the great tributes to American ingenuity and American know-how and American entrepreneurship. No, we're way ahead of the rest of the world in this. And you know, folks, the president was running around the country a few years ago saying, oh, we've got to stop using our oil and gas because we're running out of oil and gas. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not running out of oil and gas. We're running into it. We have 200 years worth of oil and gas. There's more oil and gas in North Dakota than there is in Saudi Arabia, for goodness sakes. We should be using our natural resources. Coal, we have 500 years worth of coal. 500 years worth of coal. The president says, no, we're not going to do it. The president is trying to close down and shut down our coal industry. It's happening right as we speak. You know, I live in the state of Virginia. Virginia is a coal-producing state. We have whole towns that have been eviscerated by this president. Wiped out. People have lost their jobs. This is a president who says how much he cares about working people. What about these coal miners who have lost their jobs? So we ought to be using our coal. And by the way, for every coal plant that we shut down in the United States, China, India, Mexico, Germany, all of these countries are building coal plants. So all we're doing with these kind of global warming initiatives, we're economically unilaterally disarming ourselves. And that is a shame. Number two, let's get our corporate tax rate down to the lowest in the world, not the highest in the world, right? We are trying to compete with a 35% corporate tax rate. And I said this when I testified, Mr. Hastings, before the House Ways and Means Committee a couple of weeks ago. I used this word intentionally. I said it is unpatriotic to support the United States 35% corporate tax rate, because this is chasing jobs out of the United States. And if we cut our corporate tax rate to maybe 20 or 15%, those jobs would come back to America. We've lost Burger King, we've lost Medtronics, we're losing Walgreens, we're losing major American companies that are essentially renouncing their United States citizenship, and they're moving to Ireland and Canada and other countries. Now, when that's happening, don't you think the sirens should be going off in Washington that there's something wrong? And this president won't do anything about it. And third and finally, let's repeal Obamacare. Every single word of Obamacare. Get rid of those regulations on employment, on employers. When I talk to employers, they say Obamacare is the single biggest reason why they are not hiring more workers. You all know what a 49er is, right? I'm not talking about a San Francisco 49er. A 49er is a business that has capped its employment at 49 workers because it doesn't want to have to comply with this evil law called Obamacare. If we did just those three or four things, we would see 5 to 6% growth. And I'm going to vote for whichever presidential candidate, whichever party, will do those three or four things instantly. And by the way, one of them is not Hillary Clinton, because this week she came out against, did you see this? She came out against the Keystone Pipeline. Disgusting.
You've talked a lot about the red state versus blue state model. Yep. And we're not talking about politics here. We're talking about basically the economic models that we have in red states. Yep. Yep. States that are typically voting Republican versus blue states that typically vote Democrat. And talk a little bit about the fact that we're seeing people vote with their feet.
We are.
People moving from traditionally blue states to more red states. You gave the example again at lunch today of people moving from California to Colorado, and how that's shifted Colorado, which was traditionally a Republican state, to more of a purple state now, and we're seeing that play out in the economics of both of those states.
Yeah. Look, the biggest demographic and economic cultural shift that's happening in America today that's not getting nearly enough attention is the fact that we are seeing, you know, huge shifts of population moving from some states to other. And what is happening is, look, if you look at the last five or six elections that we've had in America, the red states in America are getting redder and the blue states in America are getting bluer. I mean, there's no question about it. So the red states are generally the southern states and the mountain states and so on. And what are the blue states? Think about the states that are deep blue that are run, you know, and by the way, I don't mean, you know, red as being Republican rah-rah and Democrat, you know, bad. I mean, the states that are adopting our free market policies. Those are the red states. And the blue states, think about what states those are. Connecticut, New York, Illinois, my home state of Illinois, California, Oregon, Minnesota, and those states are falling behind year after year after year. So here's an amazing statistic. Every single day in America, 2,000 people leave on net the blue states and they're going to the red states. And I don't know if you all know this left-wing economist named Paul Krugman. He writes for the New York Times. And I debated him this summer and I confronted him with these statistics. And I said, you've got to explain to me, Paul Krugman, why all these states that did exactly what you told them to do, states like New York and Connecticut and Illinois, they're doing what you told them to do and everybody's leaving those states. I mean, Rhode Island, my God, pretty soon the last person in Rhode Island is gonna have to turn out the lights, it's so liberal. And what's happening is these people are moving. And I said, Paul Krugman, explain to yourself, why is it that people are moving this from the states that you said you were gonna create a workers' paradise? And he gets up there and he says, Steve, there's a good reason people are moving from the North and the Midwest to the South. He says it's because of the weather. And I said, that's a really interesting observation, Paul Krugman. Now I see you why you won a Nobel Prize. And I said, look, if that's their explanation for why people are moving from red states to blue states, I'm still confused about something. Please tell me, Paul Krugman, why people are packing their bags and leaving San Diego and they're going to Houston, right? Because nobody goes from San Diego to Houston for the weather. And by the way, why are people, if it's for the weather, why are people moving to North Dakota, right? I mean, North Dakota is not a place people move to the weather. People, our ideas work because that's where the jobs are. And this is really an important point, if I may. When we do our analysis of where the jobs are being created in America, you mentioned this, Chris, and Dan, you mentioned it, and I want to emphasize this. The single most important determinant that state legislators, the state legislators in this room have control over, that determines where jobs are created is whether a state is a right-to-work state. And I want to say this. Right now in America, there are 25 right-to-work states and 25 non-right-to-work states. And by the way, this is amazing. Michigan, Indiana, and Wisconsin, all in the last 4 years, have become right-to-work states. Now, I want to say this. Can we all work together fervently over the next year to make sure that the great state of Washington becomes the 26th state in America that is right-to-work, that gives every single American worker in the state of Washington the right to join a union or not to join a union? And I said this at lunch, I'll say it again. This is a basic First Amendment right. This is about whether you have the right of association, and the right of association means you have the right not to associate, and that's why right-to-work is so important.
As you know, Washington State does not have an income tax. We're one of the few states that
advantage.
Do not have.
That's a huge advantage.
And yet there are still some in our legislature who continually bring up the idea of introducing an income tax or a capital gains tax that's been talked about. Right. Talk about the what kind of advantage we would lose if we were to perhaps adopt capital gains tax.
I believe very strongly that the one thing that is keeping Washington afloat, quite frankly, because you're kind of a bluish purplish state, but if you look at a lot of your policies, you mentioned the fact that you have some of the highest workers' compensation costs in the country. The one thing that keeps this state great and that keeps this state alive economically is that you have no income tax. And by the way, there are 9 states in America that have no income tax. Tennessee, Texas, Florida, New Hampshire, Wyoming, South Dakota, Nevada, Alaska, and these are the high growth states. So every job that is created in the highest tax states, for every job that's been created in those states, 2 to 3 jobs are being created in the states that have no income tax. It matters a lot. And we have to fight like hell to make sure that the unions never adopt an income tax in this great state of Washington, period.
You know, some of our friends talk about the fact that Washington State has one of the highest minimum wage in the country. $9.47 an hour, goes up each and every year. Our friends over in Seattle have adopted the $15 an hour minimum wage. There's talk now of Spokane via the Community Bill of Rights proposal, which, by the way, if you're looking for our analysis of the Community Bill of Rights proposal, it's available out on the registration table. We just finished it. It's hot off the presses. So I encourage you to grab a copy before you leave tonight. But it would have an impact on the minimum wage here in the city of Spokane.
It sure would.
So, you know, they look at our friends, look at that minimum wage increase in Seattle, and they say, well, geez, it hasn't had an impact on Seattle's employment. In fact, Seattle just keeps growing jobs. And then they say, well, let's go ahead and increase the minimum wage statewide, and that would have a huge impact. They don't look at the correlation between the two. But we see other states, the statistic that you brought up today at lunch about Texas and the amount of employment that Texas has added over the past, I think it was 15 years or so.
Yep.
Share with folks about
that. Well, let me say something about the minimum wage. Yeah. I mean, if I have an economics class that I teach, and if any of my Economic 100 students wrote on one of their final exams that raising the minimum wage was the right thing to do, I would flunk them because it's just terrible economics. And look, how many in this room, your first job was a minimum wage job? Raise your hand. It was for me. And I'm going to give you an indication of how old I am. My first job was working for $2.10 an hour in a warehouse in suburban Chicago. And, you know, I learned more on that job than I've learned probably any job that I've ever had. The first job that you have is the most important job, right? Because you learn basic work skills, how to show up for work on time, how to be nice to your boss, how to run a cash register, how to just develop work skills that are going to pay off in the long term. Why do we want to price young people out of the workforce? The statistics are very clear. 60% of the people who earn the minimum wage are workers under the age of 25. They're young people. They're the first job that they ever have. I always tell people, look, I have, you know, three sons. I have two teenagers who I don't like very much, and I have an 11-year-old who I'm still very fond of. But, you know, my two teenagers, You know, I mean, if you have teenagers, what is it that Rodney Dangerfield said after he had teenagers? That now I know why some species eat their young. That's how I feel about my teenagers. But look, I love my two teenagers, actually. I don't always like them, but I do love them. But I would never pay them $15 an hour. I would never pay them $15 an hour because they don't have the skills to do it. They have to, you know, work $6-7 an hour, and then you build yourself up. And I think we make a big mistake when we raise the minimum wage, because it's very clear in the evidence, and the people who are hurt the most by the minimum wage are black teenagers. And, you know, the left says how much they care about, you know, blacks and Latinos. They are the victims of this. And then the other point I would make, and this is, a strategic point that we have to make every time the left brings up the minimum wage to us in every debate, because every time I do a debate against the liberal, they bring up the minimum wage. The problem in America today is not the minimum wage. You know what the problem in America today? It's the median wage. It's the middle class wage. And when we have to confront the liberals and say, wait a minute, you say how much you care about wages. You've been in charge in this country for 7 years and wages have fallen. What have you done for the middle class? We've got to talk about the middle class wage in America, not the minimum wage, because the median wage in America today is $24 an hour. It's way above the minimum wage. Only, here's an amazing statistic. Anyone who want to take a guess at what percentage of American workers today earn the minimum wage? 4%. What are we talking about? What about, Mr. President, the other 96% of workers? What are we going to do for them?
Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Moore from the Heritage Foundation. We appreciate
you very much. It's been a great pleasure to you. I'm just going to say this one last thing. You know, we are in the fight of our lives, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm a big optimist for this economy. I do think, though, that this election that is coming up is, in my opinion, the most important election in this country since 1980. We've got to win this one, and we've got to win with our ideas, with our free market ideas. We've got to win the governorship here in the state of Washington. We've got to get somebody who understands economics. And I will say this, if we get someone who understands business, and I don't care if it's a Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, somebody who is pro-business, who wants to make America succeed, who will develop our energy resources, deregulate this country, tax reform, let's have a flat tax for goodness sake in this country. If we do those things, I feel very strongly about this, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have the biggest boom in this country you ever saw, but it's going to require every single one of us to work as hard as we can. And let's make a commitment tonight. Every one of us is going to work as hard as we can to promote these ideas that create growth and prosperity. As my good friend Larry Kudlow, by the way, Larry Kudlow is going to run for the United States Senate in the state of Connecticut this year, which is great news. What is the Kudlow Creed? And I do his radio show every Saturday. Free market capitalism is the greatest path to prosperity. I wish the Pope understood that message, because it's true. Free market prosperity is the greatest path to prosperity. And the way to help, by the way, every one of you is a patriot for helping this great organization, Washington Policy Center. Why don't we think about putting an extra zero on our check this year? Let's really drive the left crazy. Very, very much appreciate being with you. Have a great dinner. Ambassador, I love you. You're so awesome. on Fox News. And Dan, what you do is spectacular. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Robin, back to you.
That was fantastic. I really like this format, Chris. I really like that. That's really, really great. And I was just checking my tweets. And I got to say, kind of impressed with Sue Madsen. Hey, you're doing a great job tweeting. Also, Neo82. Neo82 says, what? No live tweets from EWA policy AD? ? But one of the tweets I just sent out a little bit ago was that I don't normally find economists very exciting. And I apologize to all of you economists out there. But wow, he was full of energy, and I loved it. We are going to take a little break. Oh, by the way, Steve's book is out in the lobby, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of States, How Taxes, Energy, and Worker Freedom Change Everything. It's available in the lobby after the program. We're going to take about a 15-minute break, finish your dinner, and a visit with your wonderful table guests, and we'll start back up in about 15 minutes or so.